So just let the exercise team just get the basic academics. And then, you know, it's classic, but it's the crawl, walk, run. And, you know, when you look at Olympic class sprinters, they didn't just become Olympic class sprinters overnight. At one point for them, running was fun, not a profession. So you got to let them go have fun and go play for a little bit before you can turn them into an Olympic class runner.
Welcome to the Digital Warfighting Series with CENTCOM. I'm Lauren Badula with Hondo Gertz, and we're the co-host of Building the Base and launching this really exciting series with U.S. Central Command focused on bringing technology and innovation to the warfighter. Today's guest is Colonel Garrett Hogan, who goes by Nails. Nails, we're so excited to have you here and to dig into what you do every day, what drives you in terms of mission, and some examples of real technology adoption in the field. So, Nails, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here today and share whatever I can to move the mission forward.
Yeah, that's awesome, Nails. So, as we get going here, maybe just to set context a little bit, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of a sense of your background, how you got in the Air Force, what you're doing in support of the CENTCOM mission now, and kind of what got you here for this discussion today?
Yeah, no problem, sir. That's easy. I can do that. So, I actually entered the Air Force in 2001 as a graduate of Embry-Riddle's Air Force ROTC program, and then became an electronic warfare officer on the RC-135 rivet joint. My first deployment out here to CENTCOM was actually in January of 2004. So I'm celebrating my 20-year anniversary in theater this last month. So pretty good. So 24 years electronic warfare officer. I've worked surface to air aggressor. I've worked theater ballistic missile defense. I worked for NATO for 3 years, and I got a chance to be a professor at a school, giving back to what brought me into the Air Force, the Reserve Officer Training Corps. Today, I find myself in a unique situation as electronic warfare officer. I'm the Director of Combat Operations for the 609th Air Operations Center, AFCENTS A33, where I'm responsible for organizing and executing the CFAC's will, or at least the arm of CENTCOM's expression of how we're going to engage in theater.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us. And just for our listeners who maybe don't have a military background, we've got a lot of tech entrepreneurs, policy wonks, folks on the nonprofit side who join. Can you tell those that aren't really familiar with the organizational structure of CENTCOM, specifically what your role at AFCENT is, and tell us about the Combined Air Operations Center? We try to avoid acronyms. Sometimes we're bad at that ourselves, but just get our listeners up to speed on where you sit physically today. I know you're joining us from Qatar, and what your organization is focused on in this really important time.
So currently I sit as the Combat Operations Director, which is the Director of Operations for the Air Component Command inside of CENTCOM. And the Air Operations Center has multiple different components with it, one of which, where I sit, is Operations. So the Combat Operations Division. The Combat Operations Division is the very end of the targeting and planning cycle as we go through the process of the combatant command targeting. So I receive an air tasking order on what we're going to do from day to day from the combat plans division, which runs about 24 to 48 hours before I get my hands on the plan. Day to day, minute to minute, hour to hour, I'm responsible for maintaining the combatant commander and the component commander's intent in theater with respect to air operations that are executed, and then reacting to things that pop up throughout the day, problems that occur throughout the day, and then reprioritizing assets and flexing requirements to make sure that those two intents, commander's intent, are met at the end of the day. Once the ATO is complete, we take that for initial assessment, and then we push it back into the strategy cycle to inform the process as it begins anew. And we take the next ATO off the shelf and execute it. So we are a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week, 366 this year, days a year, constantly operating division.
So Nails, I appreciate the shout out to ROTC, former Air Force ROTC guy too. So good on you there. I'm also old enough to remember the old process of doing things, which was, you know, bucket loads and desk loads of paper moving. Each target had its own, you know, for a listener, you know, box of paper that flowed all around and then got checked off by a bunch of folks. Many of us have heard of Digital Falcon as kind of one of the ways you guys are trying to attack this, you know, add digital into digital warfighting. Can you give us a sense of what Digital Falcon is? What are you trying to accomplish with that? And then how it relates to, you know, keeping tabs on thousands of targets simultaneously that change all the time.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. That's actually been a enduring effort from both my predecessor and through myself as well. And it's really championed by our commander, Colonel Julie Esposito. And she's amazing in driving the requirements for improving this digital warfighting as we move forward. But the original thought of Digital Falcon was, how do we use new and emerging technologies to streamline the boxes of paper, as you referenced, sir, into something that's a little bit more capable? This Digital Falcon series was birthed probably sometime last year, probably about 6 months, 8 months before I actually arrived on station here at IUD. And the concept was, how do we take this emerging technology that's provided to us through TIER's Maven system to streamline target processing? At the time, we weren't worried so much about actually employing it as a tool. We were concerned about what the future of warfare would look like. We get the same effect from the people without actually having the requirement to send them downrange. You distribute your operations. So why do I need an intelligence analyst in place at IUD? Why can't they be at their home station and they go home at the end of every day and they're not deployed? But the extra cycles, the extra time that they have associated at home, where maybe they have a training requirement or maybe they have some other mission requirement that they need to hack to maintain currency, instead of doing it on a replicated, simulated process, why not log into this distributed intelligence system that we're developing and do target development for real? So that was the impetus for Digital Falcon. How do I distribute the intelligence architectures that I can develop targets all over the world for the region using the assets that are available to me at home station? And that turned out to be really good. And it culminated essentially in Digital Falcon Oasis 2. And that is where we had a cross-component, cross-domain, multi-level, big CENTCOM exercise with every component feeding into every other component. We're all working on this digital target workbench where we're developing targets simultaneously across domains. And we achieved I don't remember the exact number anymore, but it exceeded our 1,000 targets per day. And it was very effective. So as I'm sitting at the KR, as the senior operations duty officer, as I'm sitting in the seat, I'm seeing targets come in from various DGSs, distributed ground stations, so intelligence nodes around the world. I'm seeing targets come in from different components, land component, or maritime component, from special forces. All of these assets are feeding into the system. And as I see these targets being developed in the system and working their way through the dynamic targeting process, I see various different entities jumping in and jumping out, jumping in and jumping out. And to me, the user, it's seamless. I see a puck, literally just a rectangular piece of graphics information moving its way physically through the kill chain as all these virtual players are adding more and more information to it. And me as the offensive operator who's managing, you know, what aircraft am I going to assign to that target? What bomb am I going to assign to that target? What's the desired effect? I'm getting fed from the entire information architecture, and it greatly changes the way that I do dynamic targeting so that now it's not a bucket of paper or post-it notes being passed back and forth. I'm getting all of the actual ground-based users feeding their information directly into this puck, and I can read all their notes as I go, and they're sorted in a way such that it makes sense and it allows me to pull up that puck and brief the strike authority from that puck on wherever we happen to be operating. In one of the Digital Falcons, we had our target engagement authority actually back at Shaw, and we briefed him virtually on target engagement. As far as I know, that's the first time that's really been done using that system ever. Now, it wasn't an exercise, it wasn't real world, so caveat there, but we managed to make it work and proved a concept. And today we're proving it in the real world because we're actually doing that right now.
So I want to pull on this kind of the concept of proving it out in the real world, because with the exercise, you've placed a lot of emphasis on developing muscle memory, which requires consistency. And it sounds like you've been running these for quite some time, and you have a busy role and an increasingly busy time. So why has it been important to you and AFSCENT to keep up the drumbeat of these digital exercises? And can you expand a little bit on how you balance that with your other responsibilities, particularly in a time where these are evolving from exercise to real-world activity post-October 7 attacks?
So right now we're in an actual exercise while we're in the environment that you see in open source media regularly about everything that's happening in the Red Sea, all of the turmoil that's occurring down there. And the way that we can keep those separate is because of the digital nature of the environment. So as I'm running the exercise on the main part of the floor, while they're also running the primary operation, I've got my dynamic targeting cell, well, with their distributed architecture, also working in parallel. And the two are synced in such a way that while I'm doing the exercise and the exercise injects are coming in, I can identify a exercise puck different from a real world puck, and they can be processed simultaneously using the same process. Now, my operators know that if we get to a situation where something needs to be handled in the real world right now, they have all the authority in the world to go, okay, exercise, pause. We're going to focus on what we need to focus on and get that taken care of right now. Exercise, we'll get back to you in a minute.
That's awesome, Nails. You know, again, I hearken back to the days of old and hearing, you know, what's possible now in the when you can actually transform to an all digital world, you know, fast iteration rates, exercises and real world operations occurring at the same time. You know, if I draw my SOCOM days, it was always really important if we're going to act in that way to kind of close the distance, whether it's physical or relationship wise, between kind of engineers, the real users working use cases, and then operations and exercises. How do you view the need to, you know, if you're going to operate at this speed, how do you view that relationship changing with engineers, folks who are providing technical support to you, and your relationship with real world kind of operations activities? How do you view all those relationships changing as CENTCOM moves to this digital warfighting, not as a concept, but as a way of doing business?
So, sir, I think they become more important. And that is because of the velocity with which we're operating. So I'd like to use an example from my time in Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, when I worked counter remote control improvised explosive device electronic warfare systems. So for those in the audience that know what crew was, I was a crew guy with Combined Joint Task Force Paladin. And one of the things that we saw in that environment was the adversary was almost always faster than we were at employing new tactics on the battlefield. And then it would take us some time to adapt to that. And it was in that time of adaptation that we incurred additional risk. So that would be a period of time where there's something new on the battlefield that is uncovered by what we were providing. And then, you know, the privates and the specialists that went out there, they were the ones that really had to face that. So what I saw in that environment was probably my first instance of a field service rep. So having field service reps directly next to you and tied to your elbow as you're getting these exploitation pieces of information, the sooner I could get that to my FSR field service rep to reprogram my system, the faster I could close that gap between when something new showed up on the battlefield and when the privates and specialists were covered by their systems. So fast forward to today, 10, 15 years later. And the great thing that we have right now with what we're doing specifically with the systems that are associated with Digital Falcon and our dynamic targeting is our engineering construct is extremely responsive to our requests. So as we find issues and problems with the system, they are right there to take those lines of code. And in some cases, they have manually reprogrammed it there on the floor that night between the exercise rotations. And then the next day, we have whatever it was that we wanted. I can think of one example recently where I was talking to our representatives after one of the exercises that I don't have the ability to actually feed aircraft into the sim, so I can't get to the weapon pairing and targeting portion of the kill chain the way I want to. I have to use a fake track that's available in the environment. So I pair it to like a defensive counter air sortie that doesn't have bombs on it, or I pair it to whatever track just happens to show up in the environment. Sometimes it's like Qatar Airways, like 247. Yeah, they're not going to be dropping a standoff weapon from Qatar Airways, but it's the only track I have available in the system. What would be awesome is if you guys would let me build a sim track in the system. The next morning, they had a rudimentary simulation system built in the system that didn't exist before. So I could put in an F-16 that's loaded with the type of weapon so my guys could practice the weapon pairing, targeting, and engagement criteria. I could put in the appropriate speeds and distances to targets. So when somebody paired something to a platform, they're like, that's too far away, that's not going to work. And that gives the kind of the old Family Feud big red X sound back to the operator, which is good feedback that what you're doing is bad. Don't do that. Do the right thing, not the wrong thing. And that time and space is super important when we talk about simulation. So that was the beginning of building a process that ingests an air tasking order and then simulates tracks back out based off of that, which provides more realism, which engineers only get if they talk to the operators and are there on the floor with us to see what we are and aren't doing, what we do and don't need, and how they can make the simulation more immersive to get better training across.
Mm-hmm. Something we talk a lot about on our show, Building the Base, is how to bring an idea, and really a great idea in this sense, to fruition. And we find that policy is there, process is there, culture is often a barrier to executing on something like this. How, in this case, did a very good idea come to something that has been so consistent and successful?
So I'm going to borrow a term from my British counterparts. Uh-huh. The amount of whinging I hear on the floor every time we announce a new exercise is monumental. So I hear it all the time until they see how it actually works. And you let them, and I'm gonna use this term, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but there's educational theory tied to it. You let them play in the system.
Yeah.
So what I've found is that if I give them access to the system and give them all the tools and toys and let them just go through it for the first day or two of the exercise, don't worry about DLOs, don't worry about assessments, just let them get in there, get their hands dirty, try to break it, mess around with it, and figure out how it works. Then day three and four, now you can get it after DLOs and assessments, and the guys and the gals are more tied in and have more investment. Mm-hmm. The other thing about day one and two and allowing them to play with the system is you get great debrief points out of it, specifically for those engineers that we just talked about. Because if I take a raw operator and I give them the 101 of how to operate the system, and I say, I need you to show me what you would do or what you would want to do to pair a weapon to a target. Mm-hmm. And they go to weapon pairing and they click on this and they click on that and like, oh, hey, all the airplanes are right here. Oh, hey, all the bombs are right here. Oh, hey, all the targets are right here. Wow, that's really intuitive. That's good feedback. The same way that, where do I find weapons? How come I can't? Why are they over here? That doesn't make any sense. They should be over here. Mm-hmm. That's great feedback. And it's unvarnished feedback. So just let the exercise team just get the basic academics. And then, you know, it's classic, but it's the crawl, walk, run. And, you know, when you look at Olympic class sprinters, they didn't just become Olympic class sprinters overnight. At one point for them, running was fun, not a profession. So you got to let them go have fun and go play for a little bit before you can turn them into an Olympic class runner.
That's awesome. And just hearing your energy and passion for what you're doing, it seems contagious to me. So I can see how you can be successful in an effort like that with a little bit of patience, giving them access to technology, and then encouraging others to bubble up good ideas so that their feedback is heard. I think that's really important. And also to see how you could spread throughout the region. Pivoting, you talked about just events in the region with the Red Sea over the past couple of months. I was wondering if you can just give an overview of how, broadly speaking, the Combined Air Operations Center has changed in terms of your role because of events in the region, or dialing it back a little bit. How are things going?
So let me take it from a perspective of people as opposed to a perspective of any kind of military assessment of the situation, mm-hmm. because that is well beyond my capacity to provide anything accurate. And I'm sure there are plenty others that can mm-hmm. give you much better detail on that. But let's talk about the people. Mm-hmm. My people on the ops floor are probably the most motivated I have seen in probably since peak OEF days. And that is because they are getting a chance to go out there, make a difference. So that immediate feedback, that feeling of purpose, that feeling of making a difference, keeps them going. So from a people perspective, it could not be going any better. Many of my guys are working exceptionally long shifts, especially those that are on the targeting side of the house and this kind of more kinetic side of the house. They're working very long hours and they want to work those long hours. I say walk around the floor. I'm a big fan of leadership by walking around. So, you know, you get into the offices, you see how they're doing. Mm-hmm. They look tired. I'm like, go home. They tell me no. I'm like, I wasn't asking. I'm telling. But I appreciate your dedication, but your release here, and you can go home now. And they don't want to go.
Wow.
I'm like, look, I need you tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. Go get some rest. Go do something fun. Go take a break. That right there, as the director of combat ops, is probably the best problem I could ever hope to have. That I can't get people to detach and go home for good reasons. So that we're in a good place from that perspective. The morale is exceptionally high. Everybody values what they're doing and what we're doing, and they see how it ties into the broader aspect of national security and global stability. And that's huge for them.
Hey, Nails, you know, talking about motivating and you know, together we're stronger. You know, there's a number of I think tech companies and folks in the tech community who maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago kind of were detached from national security and kind of thought, you know, weren't really involved one way or the other. Some of that was, I think, on the DoD side, not helping them get involved. Some of that was just they didn't understand how they could impact this global situation the way they do now. What's your feedback to them as kind of an end user that gets something down the road? What things enable you to do things better with a product or an algorithm or something when it gets to you, and what things frustrate you when something comes to you from one of them? You know, what feedback would you give them as they're thinking about how they might contribute to this digital warfighting concept?
Cooperation versus competition. That would probably be step number one. If I can get tools that work together, even if they're developed by separate entities, but they are baked in to have cooperation from the beginning, that is huge. So interoperability, specifically with our joint coalition partners, is always a challenge. But I saw it when I was in Afghanistan. Last year, I was in Baghdad at the U.S. Embassy for a year, and I saw some of the same issues there when we start looking at the assets that are on the ground in that environment. Interoperability is everything. And the more interoperable you can be from various different sources, the stronger your position is technologically. And that is the angle we took at the embassy, is that by looking at U.S. capabilities and U.S. products, those are all interoperable with everybody, generally speaking, everybody and everything in the NATO construct. So that gets you a much larger perspective on the types of materiel you can get and your future as you move to an environment that's more permissible in that domain, and future integration capabilities that you have with the partners that you want to have. I can't tell you, and this was me as the director of education, exercises, and training at the U.S. Embassy last year, I can't tell you how many times Iraqi general officers would come up to me and complain about the Russian and Chinese stuff. And I'm like, well, you should have bought American because the stuff either didn't work or it didn't work with other things because it was very central aligned. And that is something that the U.S. specifically has that we have in exceptional strength. We have a lot more capacity when it comes to developing things that are designed to work together. What frustrates me is when I get things that I know should work together, but don't. Cooperation versus competition in this domain from the commercial side of the house and the industrial side of the house will move us a lot forward, a lot faster.
Thank you for highlighting that. And I think this theme of cooperation versus competition is so important across the ecosystem, but especially in industry, as we think about digital warfighting and what the future looks like on that front. So Colonel Hogan, Nails, you are so busy. It's a very important time. Thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about what you do every day. But more importantly, thank you for your service and your leadership on this front. It's so interesting to hear everything you're leading over there.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate you inviting me to this. And I'm absolutely happy to share. Hopefully something I said sparks a light of desire in somebody and motivates them. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Nails.
Thanks, Nails.
You've been listening to Building the Base, a podcast by Lauren Badula and Hondo Gertz. Remember to subscribe and share wherever you're listening. Leave a comment to suggest a guest. And for up-to-date insights on the show, join our newsletter at www.buildingthebase.org. That's www.buildingthebase.org.